Today is Wednesday, July the 3rd. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key. Big Tech has been collecting and aggregating your personal data. Do you know how big tech companies are using your personal data? We have been bringing computer news, hardware and software reviews, guest interviews, and news of user group meetings for the past 40-plus years. The Personal Computer Show is a 3-time winner of the prestigious National Computer Press Awards. Our only advocacies are consumerism and the First Amendment. I welcome you, the listeners, to provide feedback as to what you want to hear. Address your suggestions to hank@pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. PRN.live also streams the program on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.live on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. It seems that the demand for energy is growing exponentially. Increasing energy demands from the AI sector prompt tech leaders like Sam Altman and Bill Gates to advocate for nuclear power as a sustainable solution. Innovations in nuclear technology, including smaller, more standardized reactors, aim to reduce construction costs and compete with natural gas. Bill Gates is ready to sink billions into getting next-generation nuclear energy off the ground in the United States. The world's sixth richest man has been a staunch nuclear supporter for years now and has already sunk over $1 billion of his own money into this innovative nuclear power startup, TerraPower LLC. Nuclear power has been gaining traction around the globe as a viable option for national and private decarbonization strategies. Nuclear advocates argue that we can no longer afford to ignore nuclear's immense and clean energy potential, and it is a proven technology with plenty of existing infrastructure, legal precedent, and huge output capacity. While it's not considered to be a renewable energy, nuclear energy emits zero carbon emissions and could be a key part of a viable pathway to meeting global emission targets. Finding new ways to drum up a whole lot of clean energy output in a hurry has become increasingly urgent as the tech sector and artificial intelligence in particular suck up to rapidly increasing colossal amounts of energy. In fact, the increased demand from the tech sector has become so extreme that for the first time in years, energy demand growth from the developed world has surpassed that of developed countries, flipping a long-running script on its head. Currently, the entire IT industry is responsible for over 2% of global COT emissions, Science Alert reported in 2023. And that's just the beginning. Technological research and consulting firm Gartner projects that without major industry and policy changes, the AI sector will be solely responsible for over 3.5% of global electricity consumption as soon as 2030. Sam Altman is also a heavy advocate for nuclear fusion research. The AI systems of the future will need tremendous amounts of energy, and this fission and fusion can help deliver them. Altman was quoted in the Wall Street Journal last summer. Not only do some of the biggest names in big tech think that nuclear energy is the key to keep the tech sector's carbon footprint in check, they also think it could be a profitable venture, especially with some of the innovations that these disruptors are bringing to their new age nuclear reactors. Historically, one of the biggest hurdles for nuclear power expansion has been the high construction cost of new plants, but smaller and more standardized reactors could be a major factor to cut down on those costs. Julian Assange agrees to plead guilty in exchange for release, ending a standoff with the United States. Julian Assange, and what did he do? Mr. Assange ran WikiLeaks, a website that published many confidential or restricted official reports related to war, Spying and Corruption. In 2010, it released a video from a U.S. military helicopter which showed civilians being killed in the Iraqi capital, Baghdad. It also published thousands of confidential documents supplied by former U.S. Army intelligence analyst Chelsea Manning. These suggested that the U.S. military had killed hundreds of civilians in unreported incidents during the war in Afghanistan. The revelations became a huge story, prompting reaction from all corners of the globe and led to intense scrutiny of American involvement in foreign conflicts. The United States said the leaks had endangered the lives of American personnel. Julian Assange was accused of conspiring to break into its military databases to acquire sensitive information and was charged with 18 offenses. Efforts were made to bring him to the United States for prosecution, which he fought for 14 years in some of the world's highest courts. Julian Assange has always argued that he exposed serious abuses by U.S. armed forces and that the case against him was politically motivated. Barring last-minute snags, the deal would bring to an end a prolonged battle that began after WikiLeaks founder became alternately celebrated and reviled for revealing state secrets in the 2010s. Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks, agreed to plead guilty on Monday to a single felony count of illegally obtaining and disclosing national security material in exchange for his release from a British prison, ending his long and bitter standoff with the United States. Julian Assange, age 52, was granted his release to appear before a federal judge at one of the more remote outposts of the federal judiciary, the courthouse in Saipan, the capital of the Northern Mariana Islands, according to a brief court filing that was made public late Monday. It was a fitting final twist in the case against Mr. Assange, who doggedly opposed extradition to the United States mainland. The islands are a United States commonwealth in the middle of the Pacific Ocean and much closer to Julian Assange's native Australia, where he is a citizen, than courts in the continental United States or Hawaii. Barring last-minute snags, the deal would bring to an end a prolonged battle that began after Mr. Assange became alternately celebrated and reviled for revealing state secrets in the 2010s. Spectrum announces price hikes. American cable giant Spectrum is raising its TV, internet, and phone plan prices in July. Spectrum's internet-based price will increase by $3 a month for all plans beginning in July, CNET reported. The provider's home phone plans and TV select service will also increase by $3 in some states. It is the second time Spectrum, one of America's main cable providers, along with Comcast Infinity, DirecTV, and Dish, has hiked its rates this year alone. In January, Spectrum raised its low-income plan from $20 to $25 a month. Spectrum's internet base price will increase by $3 a month for all plans beginning in July. At the same time in January, it also raised the price of renting a router from the company from $5 to $7 a month. Existing customers wishing to negotiate the price rises may have trouble contacting the company's customer service because call centers have recently been shut. Spectrum closed 3 call centers over the last 2 months, laying off 745 employees in the process, the outlet reported. It comes after a recent earnings report shows Spectrum lost 72,000 internet customers and 405,000 cable TV customers in the first 3 months of 2024. Spectrum said in a statement, "We continue to expand and improve our offering to ensure all customers have products and packages that best meets their needs." What is a leap second? And why do we use it? The leap second adds 1 second to a day to keep the year and a second synced. But do we really need it? This past Sunday, June 30th, everyone got an extra second. Yes, the day is 1 second longer than the previous day because of a leap second. You might think the leap second is just like a leap day. Well, it's the same in that it adds time to the value of a year, but the reasons are slightly different. The leap day is an extra day to account for the non-integer number of Earth rotations as it orbits the Sun. But what about the leap second? Well, let's take a look. Why leap seconds? The source of the problem behind the leap second is that there are two definitions of the unit of time. From the beginning, humans measure time with the Sun. At some point, someone decided that the time it takes for the Sun to go from the highest point in the sky, that's at noontime, to the next time is at the highest point where it would be a day. Once you have a day, you can divide this into 24 hours. Each hour is divided into 60 minutes, and each minute is divided into 60 seconds. That's your second. It's 1 over 86,400, or 1/86/400th of a day. Fast forward to modern times, we now have a better definition of a second, atomic clocks. There are two reasons to use an atom for a clock instead of the Earth's motion around the Sun. First, the time scale is smaller. Instead of one unit of time being a year, one oscillation for an atomic clock is much shorter than a second. Second, the frequency of oscillation for an atomic clock is reproducible. If we state the exact conditions for the atomic oscillation, anyone should be able to create the unit of time. It wouldn't matter if you're on Earth, Mars, or somewhere else. For the current definition of a second, we use the oscillations of electron transitions in cesium-133. But what does this have to do with a leap second? Well, here's the problem. A year is still one trip of the Earth around the Sun, but a second is measured with an atomic clock. How do you make these two measurements agree? Yes, you have to make small adjustments. This is exactly what happens with a leap second. It's a small adjustment to the year so that both measurements of time, which is year and second, can agree. But should we have leap seconds? The International Earth Rotation and Reference System is a body that makes the decisions about leap seconds. But leap seconds create a problem. When we deal with computer systems in which every second is important, the computers have to know about these leap seconds. If you don't, their clocks can be off and cause all sorts of problems as they did the last time there was a leap second. The Atlantic, Demetrios Matsakis, who is the chief scientist for time services at the U.S. Naval Observatory, claims that we should just stop making leap second adjustments. Instead, he suggests we should let the day keep getting shifted until the Sun reaches its highest point in the sky at 1 p.m. Let 1 o'clock be the new noon. I think it's a good idea. Let's also stop with daylight savings time, too. Well, on second thought, I liked more daylight in the evening. Well, with cord cutting, it's been with cable subscriptions. Now cord cutting has extended to streaming services. Paramount Global shuts down cable network websites. In a cost-cutting move, Paramount Global announced they were shutting down the MTV News website. The announcement was soon followed by Paramount's decision to shut down the websites of cable properties, CMT, Comedy Central, TV Land, and Paramount Network, removing all online content. According to several reports, users attempting to access the websites were instructed to access or subscribe to the company's SVOD service, Paramount. In a statement, Paramount said, as part of broader website changes across Paramount, we have introduced more streamlined versions of our sites, driving fans to Paramount Plus to watch their favorite show. Paramount also mentioned content for their cable networks are available via your TV provider. At the end of the first quarter 2024, Paramount Plus, which was launched in 2021, had 71 million global subscribers, a quarterly increase of 3.7 million. Despite the steady increase, the streaming unit has yet to become profitable. In the first quarter 2024, Paramount's streaming unit lost $286 million. On a positive note, the losses have subsided. In the first quarter of 2023, Paramount's direct-to-consumer division reported a loss of $511 million. According to Nielsen's Gauge report for May, Paramount Plus had a TV audience share of 1.2%, below rival streamers YouTube, Netflix, Prime Video, Hulu, Disney Plus, Tubi, and Roku, comparable to Max and Peacocks. Paramount Global recently announced a rate increase for Paramount Plus. The cost of Paramount Plus with Showtime will increase $1 to $12.99 monthly. The monthly cost for Paramount Plus with ads also increased $1 to $7.99. The cost of Paramount Plus Essential Plan will increase $2 to $7.99 monthly for new subscribers. Paramount expects their streaming unit to be profitable by the end of next year. The cost increases will take effect later this year. The closing of the MTV News website comes more than 1 year after Paramount, amid layoffs, shut down the MTV News division. MTV News was launched in 1987 with Kurt Loder as the program's host. At first, MTV News was a weekly program on the cable network before airing nightly. The MTV News website was launched in 1996. Hence, decades of pop culture news, interviews, and other features are suddenly no longer available. Amazon to challenge Temu and Shein with new bargain site. Amazon takes on Chinese rivals Temu and Shein with plans for new discount service. Amazon plans channel for low-cost China goods to fend off Temu and Shein. First, some background information. Who is Temu? Temu is an online marketplace operated by the Chinese e-commerce company PDD Holdings. It offers heavily discounted consumer goods, mostly shipped directly from China. The platform first went live in the United States in September of 2022 and has gained popularity due to its low prices and a strategy of giving free items to users who promote the app on their social networks. But there are concerns and controversies. Despite its popularity, Temu has drawn concerns over various issues, including data privacy, forced labor, intellectual property, and the quality of its marketplace products. The company has also faced complaints regarding undelivered packages, mysterious charges, incorrect orders, and unresponsive customer service. And as of January 2024, the company has a Better Business Bureau rating of C+ and has received more than 30 complaints to the Better Business Bureau. And who are the owners of Temu? Temu is owned and operated by TPD Holdings, a multinational commerce group registered in the Cayman Islands, which also lists Dublin as its principal office address. PDD Holdings also owns Pinduoduo, a popular online commerce platform in China. The company ships tens of millions of packages to the United States each year from roughly 80,000 sellers who list products on its website. What's the legitimacy and safety of Temu? There have been questions about the legitimacy and safety of using Temu. While the platform offers a diverse selection of products at suspiciously low prices, concerns have been raised about the quality of items, potential sale of fake brands, and issues with specific vendors selling through Temu. However, it's important to note that Temu has stated that it cares deeply about data privacy and has a zero-tolerance policy for forced labor, taking measures to ensure compliance with the United States law on the issue. And the other company is Shein. Shein is a Singapore-headquartered global online fashion and lifestyle retailer that offers a full range of products centered around customer needs. The company operates with a customer-driven, on-demand model that addresses the mismatch between customer demand and merchandise supply, aiming to improve outcomes for both supplier partners and customers. Shein serves customers in 150-plus countries from key centers of operations around the world, including the United States, Brazil, Ireland, and southern China. The company was originally known as Shownside.com and was registered in March of 2011, initially advertising itself as a worldwide leading wedding dress company, although it also sold general women's wear. In 2015, the business shifted its focus to fast fashion apparel and rebranded as Shein. The company's rise to prominence occurred in 2020, coinciding with a surge in e-commerce due to quarantine shoppers. Shein's innovative on-demand, customer-driven model aims to address customer preferences more accurately and efficiently, resulting in more affordable prices and less waste. The company average customer is a 34.7-year-old woman who earns $65,300 in annual income and reports spending $100 per month on women's clothing. Well, Amazon.com plans to launch a service focused on shipping cheap fashion wear, household goods, and other products directly from warehouses in China as it faces growing competition from low-cost e-commerce platforms Temu and Shein. In the invite-only meeting with Chinese merchants last Wednesday, Amazon unveiled a plan to debut a new channel on its platform to sell unbranded fashion wear and household products from China, according to a presentation viewed by the Wall Street Journal. Amazon said it would ship the products directly from China to consumers in the United States with 9 to 11 days of order placement. Until now, goods sold by Chinese merchants to Amazon's U.S. customers typically have been routed through warehouses in the United States. One slide in the presentation depicting a mock-up of a digital storefront showed products including phone cases, mugs, and face massage tools. An Amazon spokesperson said the company is always exploring new ways to work with our selling partners and offer customer lower prices and a greater selection. The spokesperson did not elaborate on plans for the new channel. Amazon's plan, earlier reported by The Information, marks a significant step by the U.S. e-commerce giant to safeguard its market leadership at home amid increasing competition from bargain app Temu, owned by China's PDD Holdings, and fast fashion giant Shein. Both companies are able to offer lower prices in part because they avoid the expense of fast delivery. They ship products directly from China and don't store much inventory in the United States. Amazon's new service suggests that it is willing to loosen some of its own delivery standards for certain products to stay competitive. Temu, Shein, and other e-commerce companies benefit from a U.S. statute that allows shipments with a value of $800 or less to enter the country without facing certain tariffs. Merchants who are part of Amazon's new service could also benefit from the rule. The only way Amazon could match prices was to replicate the supply chain advantage, said the founder of market research firm Marketplace Pulse. Fast deliveries and easy returns have been a staple of Amazon's strategy, while Temu and Shein have drawn customers with low prices. Amazon executives have been weighing how to respond to the two competitors who have wagered that there is a market for bargain items that take longer to arrive, in which the journal has previously reported. The two upstart e-commerce platforms have expanded rapidly to threaten Amazon. Temu was listed as the Apple Store's most downloaded free app in the United States last Thursday, while Shein ranked 7th, according to data provider Sensor Tower. Shein, along with social media powerhouse TikTok, has sought to poach Amazon employees as part of its goal to build out logistics and supply chain operations in the United States. Amazon has responded to the threats by trying to find ways to make its bargain items more visible to customers. It has worked to increase the selection of items available for same-day delivery in categories such as electronics and explored promotional campaigns that would emphasize reliability, and delivery speeds. It also earlier lowered some seller fees for cheap apparel items. Amazon informed Chinese sellers that it would start signing up merchants this summer and begin accepting inventory in the fall. Sellers on this new platform can select their product offerings, set their own prices, and produce in small batches to test market demand. An Amazon spokesperson said, "We are always exploring new ways to work with our selling partners to delight our customers with more selection, lower prices, and greater convenience." It remains unclear if Amazon will utilize a U.S. trade provision that exempts individual packages valued at less than $800 from customs duties. When there's competition, we get a lot of excitement on prices and goods. Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where, yes, I talk about computers, technology, and the workplace. And I wanted to take you on a journey through the life of an information technology professional. That would be me. And how did I get here? How did everything evolve over the years? Of course, I started early on just tinkering with computers. I was definitely interested in them in the early 80s when I had my first computer. And I went to a school, a private school, which happened to have computers around, that we had a very nice computer lab. We learned on, you may not have heard of these, Commodore PETs and the old Apple II series were very prevalent throughout the school. And then later on, I started into sales in the late 80s. Now, all of this was in the days of the early adopters. This was when people that were buying computers were the tinkerers, the hackers. These were the people who were very, very experimental with computers. They were learning a lot of different things about technology and adopting it. So if somebody ran into a problem, they looked for ways to move through, to move around, and to overcome. And I'm taking that's one of the big military sayings, move through, around, and overcome. All right. So I was actually one of those. I was looking into a lot of different things with computers, and every time I stumbled into a problem, I did my best to solve it on my own. And that included, I ran a bulletin board service. This was in the days before the internet as we know it. This was in a time and day when, yes, people would dial up their modems and talk to from their computer to another computer over the phone lines. It wasn't until the late 90s when we had broadband. But then I get out of my whole journey here. So I became a field tech in 1991. I was applying what I learned to fix the problems in businesses and coming alongside people who were denying that they were nerds, but they still were, just sometimes in over their heads, and they needed a very quick exit from their problems. A few years later, I worked for a few different companies that were innovators. Now, at this point, they had ideas that computers would take their businesses to the next level. They knew that they had to get on board or get left behind, and I moved them forward. Each of the different companies that I did tech for, I made sure that they were part of the new information age that was coming. I built a website, actually I built a couple of websites that were among the first 100,000. And when you consider today that it's near 2 billion websites, that's a huge jump. Now moving on, I later worked with the early majority. Now this was still tech support, but it started to move away from what the computer was doing wrong to what the person was doing wrong. There was plenty of tech side support, but not quite what people imagine. It started to evolve into a world of knowing and learning what people changed, what they mistook as a proper path, and then guiding them. It wasn't about the tech, increasingly over the years, but about the people. Today, I leverage all of that knowledge from all the way along the way. And today, it's about knowing these changes and educating people about how to take the proper roads in tech. Yes, there are plenty of people who are in those different levels behind me that I've already mentioned. But today, a lot of my approach is about being a leader rather than chasing problems. I seek to find ways to stop these problems from happening in the first place. It's no longer about making computers do what nobody expected out of them. And yes, there are people who do that. But today, a lot of what I do is helping people to understand how to integrate the power of computing and technology that is all around us and integrating that all into our lives. So yes, today, I also, having seen so many of these different things along the way, I will take a lot of approach of guiding people away from the edge of saying certain things or certain people are moving too fast. I think of that in the world of artificial intelligence, which is, again, artificial and not so intelligent. But all of this is in part recognizing that you can't go from walking in a bicycle with training wheels and moving from there, skipping a lot of the different things in between, and then moving straight into a rocket-powered motorcycle built for extreme drag racing without knowing the implications. Yes, I want to encourage everybody to continue to learn technology, to leverage everything that comes our way. But as I am very cynical about artificial intelligence, all of this different AI stuff, which is, it's just a fancy name for explaining stuff that we don't understand. I want all of us to recognize that there is a journey for each of us. Just as I've had my journey of learning technology and guiding people through technology, getting from way back when to now, you also, every one of you, needs to take a very similar learning path, going from, yes, an early adopter to something that we may not even have imagined. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. You know, I remember that back in the 2010s, which is about 10, 15 years ago, they said that personal computing was dead. No one was buying personal computers people were buying personal computers, but sales were down. And they didn't realize that people do use personal computers, but they were able to upgrade the personal computer by adding more memory, changing the mass storage devices, and for those who were capable and when it was possible, they were able to swap out the CPU to make it run faster. If you can upgrade something that brings you to the latest processing speeds, then why do you want to spend more money and get rid of something that works and just fill up the recycling points all around the world, creating a greater problem? Well, the industry got smart. You know how they got smart, right? Well, here's the latest one. Intel's latest laptops get rid of replaceable memory. Now, that's really going beyond. It's getting pretty hard to find a laptop with a user-accessible SODIMM slot to upgrade the memory. And it's about to get a lot harder. Starting with its upcoming Lunar Lake laptop CPU series, Intel will install memory into the processor itself, offering only 16 gigabytes or 32 gigabytes initially. Yes, Intel laptops are getting rid of user-replaceable RAM, at least for this series of chips. Intel is following Apple's lead here. The latter installs memory along with its home-built ARM-based M processors, in the same way that memory is offered on smartphones and tablets. It means that these new Intel laptops will offer fewer choices to manufacturers and none at all to consumers after the purchase. The technical part is that we want to have an exquisite notebook that will take on ecosystem competitors, said Jim Johnson, a senior vice president at Intel. And that's what we build. And we think, meaning Intel, 16 gigabytes and 32 gigabytes is the right matchup. And yes, it's not upgradable beyond that. Of course, as we know, Microsoft has already said that the AI PC needs at minimum 32 gigabytes. So when you start needing more than 32 gigabytes, guess what? You can add memory. You just have to need to buy a new machine. But this is the cornerstone of their new architecture. What alternatives are there with the end of support for Windows 10 PCs? Some perfectly good Windows 10 PCs can't be upgraded to Windows 11. It is estimated there are 240 million Windows 10 that cannot be upgraded to Windows 11. Microsoft end of support for Windows 10 is October 14, 2025. IT asset management firm LandSweepers count is 40% of all enterprise workstations can't make the grade, which would put the number of Windows 10 PCs that cannot be upgraded at about 400 million units. What alternative options do you have? Many older Windows 10 machines don't have the CPU or the Trusted Platform Module, TPM, needed for Windows 11. The TPM isn't usually a problem, but if you have a PC from 2019 or earlier, the CPU likely will be unsupported. One option is to just keep running Windows 10 without support, only if you have a death wish. Your machine will be hacked. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. It's not a recommended option. Another option is to buy a new computer, of course, assuming that you have the money to do it. Windows 11 doesn't work and play that well on cheap hardware, so that means that to enjoy running Windows 11, you need a higher-end laptop or PC with much more memory and storage that you think you might need. These offer better performance, more storage, and quality displays, but you may be in for sticker shock. You may want to force Windows 11 on your Windows 10 PC. You could hack your way to installing Windows 11 on your PC, even though, officially, Microsoft won't support you if you try this trick. It's a bit complicated upgrading an unsupported Windows 10 PC to Windows 11. It can be done, and it's all not that hard either. There's also an open source program, Rufus, makes it easy to do this. This bootable USB drive creation program gives you the option of skipping Windows 11 system requirements when you try to do an in-place upgrade. Keep in mind, though, that Windows 11 might not work that well or at all on your older PC. Well, there's another option, that is to replace Windows 10 with a Linux distro. There is, however, a learning curve when switching operating systems. An advantage of running Linux is that your PC will never be left behind. You can use bottles and wine that will enable you to install Windows software in Linux. Bottles is similar to wine, a popular compatibility layer for Windows, but it offers some advanced options and an intuitive graphical environment. It allows users to install Windows software on Linux with ease and provides advanced options and an intuitive graphical environment. Bottles also includes various runners, which are different builds or variations of Wine, to easily tweak in stores with a few clicks of the button. It operates within contained areas that keep all in stores separated, providing a form of sandboxing from the rest of the system. If you really can't see yourself learning Linux, how about Chrome OS? Thanks to Chrome OS Flex, you can take pretty much any PC from the last decade or so and get it running Chrome OS. You can install and run Chrome OS Flex on any PC with a 64-bit processor, 4 gigabytes of RAM, 16 gigabytes of storage, and can be booted from a USB drive. It's easy to move any Windows machine to Chrome OS Flex. Oh, is there a Windows application you can't live without? Leaving aside that software companies are dumping standalone applications in favor of software as a service, such as Microsoft 365. You now can run essentially any Windows app on a Chromebook. Cameo and Google's new virtual app delivery, that's a VAD service, enables you to run legacy apps on any Chromebook. There they will appear as Progressive Web Apps, that's PWA, and Microsoft uses this cloud-based approach itself to deliver applications. By the way, neither Linux or Chrome OS Flex will cost you a single dime. They're free. Another option is, well, pay the piper. Pay Microsoft for Windows 10 extended support. Microsoft will offer extended security support, that's ESUs, for Windows 10. For businesses, they have 3 years of it. First year, $61 per device. Second year, double that to $122 per device. Third year, $244 per device. And for education customers, it ranges from $1 to $4 per unit. $1 for the first year for the license, $2 for the second year, and $4 for the third year. For Windows 365 customers, extended security updates will be included at no additional expense for Windows 10 devices accessing Windows 365 cloud PCs. In addition, the extended support updates provide only security updates. There will be no new features or non-security patches. If you run into trouble, technical support will be limited and require an active support plan. So in summary, commercial organizations will pay $61 to $244 per device over 3 years, while education gets heavy discounted pricing of $1 to $4 per license. Consumer pricing is still to be determined. Then there is the equivalent of extended security support from an external company, OPatch, which offers customized patches for out-of-service operating systems. For example, OPatch offers support for Windows Server 2012 until 2026, while Microsoft drops support for it in October of 2023. It's expected the company also will offer support for Windows 10 for about $25 a year per unit. Well, here's a quick recap. Just running Windows 10 without support? Not recommended unless you have a death wish. Buying a new computer? That is the optimum solution. If your budget can make it. Next is force Windows 11 on your Windows 10 PC. It's not recommended if you're running mission-critical apps. Next is to replace 10 with a Linux distro running bottles and wine. But you may very well have to learn new navigation procedures. Next is Chrome OS Flex, only if all your apps run in the cloud. And then there is the pay Microsoft for Windows 10 extended support. And so far as using the company OPatch, well, if you're going to pay for it, think about buying a new machine or using the Microsoft extended support. In all cases, when it comes to your Windows 10 unit being obsolete, don't trash out your Windows 10 PCs. There are many ways to give them a long, useful life after Microsoft retires them. Of course, if you want to gift an operating system to a friend, a user, some family, and they just want to browse on the internet, do a factory reset on it so you'll get the basic operating system. And this way you don't have to worry about putting a good old friend, a Windows 10 PC system, out to pasture. Presenting Technology Chatter with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston.
Marty Winston joins me now.
Well, I was going to say, speaking of answers, I have a question you might be able to answer.
Yes.
For your first computer, how were applications delivered?
Let's see here. They were delivered via either a cartridge that you plugged into the side of it, or via a cassette tape.
All right. And then there were floppy disks.
Floppy disks didn't come along for me for quite a few years.
A deck of Hollerith punch cards then.
No punch cards. Yeah, but yeah, you've got the idea. As a matter of fact, you can see up on the shelf right there. You probably recognize the TRS-80 Model 100.
I do indeed.
Yeah.
What I wanted to point out is software applications have always been just a little bit inconvenient.
A little bit. Yes. Okay. They ranged from a little bit to very inconvenient.
Right. And compatibility issues were rampant. Sometimes you would have upgrades of your operating system 4 times a day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Really was
mm-hmm.
that bad? And if you're on a network, multiply that.
Mm-hmm.
So dealing with all of these things. Now, if you've got all these people who in a latter era, a more recent era, would get software on CDs.
Yeah.
Or DVDs, data.
Yeah, yeah.
DVDs and load them into their systems to get, for example, Microsoft Office, that
right,
kind of thing.
Right, yeah.
Now you are in a corporate environment, and in the corporate environment, keeping all of those at the same version and compatible with each other was how much fun?
Oh, it's a blast. It's so
about
fun.
As much fun as watching parking meters violate themselves.
Yes, yes.
Yes. So the industry, the software application industry, started looking at answers. And about this time, with the falling price of increasing capacity hard drives,
mm-hmm.
farms grew. Mm-hmm. You could have an Amazon Web Service that had huge, huge server farms that were mostly about storage and dispersal,
mm-hmm.
a disbursement, a dispersal. You can have both.
Yes. Got it. Yep.
Right. So the idea of delivering software that was always at the same level to every desk in an office
mm-hmm.
became very attractive to the IT guys and very attractive to some of the C-suites.
Sure.
And that was called SaaS, S-A-A-S, for Software as a Service.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, I want to point out, SaaS is not an application. It's a delivery mechanism.
Right.
It's often confused. There are a lot of companies that claim, we're in SaaS now. What you do? Plug in?
Yeah.
SaaS applications, it's a fine way to deliver them. And for a lot of companies that aren't Microsoft, it gives them a chance to try to get into a fray. And now you go into a company that happens to need you to track, something weird, insurance statistics or medical statistics or HIPAA regulations or what have you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And getting a customized application is easier if you've got a company authoring SaaS applications specific to their needs. And then you can generalize too. Mm-hmm, everybody mm-hmm. needs accounts payable, accounts receivable, payroll, all that stuff. Tracking performance of people and reporting and turning work into data. All of those things can happen with SaaS applications. Now, here's where the problem lies. SaaS vendors, there are a few exceptions, and I'm going to point to Microsoft as one of the biggest exceptions. SaaS vendors were developing applications for compatibility with systems. As a result, the IT guys loved them. C-suites loved them.
Mm-hmm.
Users seldom love them. Users are sometimes neutral. They sometimes surrender themselves to them.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
most users hate SaaS applications. Why? Because they treat them like idiots, because they're very, very demanding, because they're not written for humans. And it's not a hard thing to do.
Sure.
You need clarity and you need charity.
Yeah.
Clarity being, tell me exactly what I'm putting in here. And charity being, if it isn't quite looking like the answer I want, help me get the right answer. You're an application. You should be able to go across the system and find me the help I need or do it for me.
Yes.
Now, how smart would that be? You cut down on the support tickets by about 15-1. You cut down on the training needs initially and later on, and everybody not only becomes more productive, they become more confident. But go find somebody other than Microsoft to ever write SaaS applications for human beings.
You're right. It's hard to find. Actually, my biggest problem with SaaS is if it goes down for one person, if there's a bug for one, it's a bug for everybody.
That can
snowball into a disaster.
You don't want to have just your cell phone number listed on everybody in the company.
Yes, yes. There's so many different directions that it's an interesting world to pursue, but you've got to use Microsoft as the right as that standard, and you've got to follow that.
Any companies out there, if you're C-suite in a company that is an author of SaaS applications, we're available to consult to you.
yes. Oh boy.
I didn't say free.
Thank you for clarifying that. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell, and that is Marty Winston. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin, and thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer Club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Log on to the club website for more information on remote meeting ID. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, July the 5th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Jitsi. Website is acgnj.org. The King's Bite Computer Club meets Tuesday, July 9th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. They meet at the Park Plaza Restaurant, 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn. The number is 347-278-7320. Tech Ed Connect meets Thursday, July 11th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is wpcug.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, July the 11th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. And the website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, July the 12th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom, and their website is limac.org. The Brookdale Computer Users Group meets Thursday, July the 25th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., online virtual meeting, and the website is bcug.com. Happy computing! Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN, live streaming on the Internet. Podcast of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.